Welcome to a Punstemology.
Just a moon doctor. You know what I like a lot more than materialistic things? Knowledge. What is this?
It's a podcast.
Greetings. I'm Dr. Mark Fabian from the University of Tasmania and Cambridge University. Thanks for joining me for another episode of a Podstomology, the show where we platform early career researchers and give them an opportunity to talk about their research passions and you an opportunity to learn from the best and brightest at the frontier of knowledge. The advancement of healthcare is one of the hallmarks of development, an essential objective of not-for-profit, public and private organizations, especially in the developing countries of Africa. The study of this sector is enormously complex as it brings together issues of medicine, political economy, anthropology, and regulation. To help us get a handle on it, I'm joined this episode by Dr. Victoria Tefese, who is a health economist and research fellow working on a range of topics in this space as part of a multidisciplinary team at the University of York's Centre for Health Economics. We discuss the role health plays in development, the idiosyncratic features of developing countries with respect to healthcare provision, how we can improve outcomes in the space, and what to expect from the next 10 years of activity and research.
Apodstomology.
Welcome, Victoria Tefese, to Apodstomology. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us a bit about your research.
Yeah, sure. So I am currently a research fellow at the Centre for Health Economics at the University of York. And I am mainly working on quite large multidisciplinary global health projects. Mm-hmm. And the focus of my research has been to understand healthcare provision, mainly in Southern and Eastern Africa. So together with my co-authors, we're trying to understand what motivates and incentivizes providers and what the nature of healthcare markets are. And if there are differences in the objectives of various providers, governmental, non-governmental, mm-hmm. and how this may interact with public health policies or health interventions. And yeah, so we're trying to understand both the supply side of healthcare, but I also find it quite interesting to look at the demand side and how that kind of interacts with health policy and healthcare provision. Previously, I was doing a PhD at the University of Sussex in economics. And then my PhD was mostly concerned with nutrition. Mm-hmm. So questions related to how the social and policy environment and the geography affects mm-hmm. Children's health. Right. Both obesity in the UK, and then two of my chapters looked at the role and impact of universal salt iodization in mm-hmm. India on cognitive outcomes and height. Yeah.
Cool.
So I guess the main research questions there were how public health or how the social and nutritional environment affects human capital outcomes. So My PhD was more about the demand and the determinants of health side, and now my work is more on the supply side.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. All right, well, lots to talk about. I guess my first question, which is, I find that I ask this question a lot because this is one of the few podcasts where you'll get this question a lot, which is, what are some of the research methods that you use in this space? So I guess I'm particularly interested in how you studied obesity, because I know that that's one of the main, I don't know if battleground is the right term to use, but I recall a talk from someone at Brookings Institution when I was there, where they were specifically saying that randomized controlled trials had failed to solve obesity, and that we had to use agent-based models at a minimum because it was such a kind of complex systems-based problem. So what are the research methods in that sort of stuff?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So the research question that we had was to look at how the access to fast food affects children's BMI. Mm-hmm. And we had to kind of go back in time, because if we would use data from today, so a mm-hmm. lot of the literature looking at this question uses epidemiological, like cross-sectional data. Mm-hmm. Sure. And there are some more kind of robust studies as well. The problem there is that there is a lot of indigeneity, mm-hmm. that we don't know whether households or individuals live in areas where there are other access to supermarkets or less access to healthy like green spaces or gyms, mm-hmm. for example, that might impact body weight. And there might be selective targeting of fast food chains, for example. Mm-hmm. And the issue is also that fast food is accessible for like everywhere in high-income mm-hmm. countries. And it's difficult to kind of get a before and after kind sure. of difference. And there isn't a lot of variation across space and time. Mm-hmm. So what me and my PhD supervisor did was actually using data from when fast food establishments started to open up in the UK. Okay. So yeah. use data from, so we have fast food outlet data from, I think, 1964 to 1986. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Which we combine with the BCS, British Cohort Study. Mm-hmm. So we have BMI outcomes, which mm-hmm. are measured by their nurses, so rather than mm-hmm. self-reports, mm-hmm. in 1986. So we're trying to, because there was more variation across space and time when they grew mm-hmm. up, so we're trying to look at both the kind of duration of exposure and distance, like proximity of exposure mm-hmm. as well. And so I guess this answers the question to why we can't use an RCT, because mm-hmm. we're kind of relying on this historical quote unquote natural experiment. Mm-hmm. And the other reason why we're using historical data is also that it looked like fast foods organizations didn't really know much about who they were targeting. So they mm-hmm. weren't as selective in targeting certain households. And today we know that there is a strong correlation between low socioeconomic status, mm-hmm. access to these type of outlets, and access to other residential predictors of health. And also, we know that there's a social gradient in BMI as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess this is the explanation to why we're not really, I'm not really well versed in the kind of RCT experiments. I guess they would be more related to how the consumption of fast food would directly impact body weight, rather than this question being related to how does the access of fast food outlets affect body weight. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I think the RCT stuff was mostly around policies to combat obesity. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're working on having healthier canteen meals or something like that, mm-hmm. what is the effect? But that canteen intervention takes place, as you said, in this kind of broader socioeconomic circumstance where if all the norms around the child suggest that having a high BMI is fine or eating certain kinds of foods is cool or whatever, then that's not going to really have an effect. But if you intervene on those things without addressing what's being sold in the cafeteria, then you won't really get the outcomes either. So I just recall reading an evaluation, and usually I guess when we talk about evaluation, we talk about randomized controlled trials, but that was sort of the argument of this paper, was that you can't evaluate these things in that way. Of something called the Romp and Chomp Scheme, which I think is a hilarious name, which was a community-based intervention to get kids eating better. I think chomp was meant to be a reference to like more vegetables, like kind of crunchier foods, and romping was more about just being active, like walking to school and that sort of thing. And yeah, I was trying to kind of do a lot of the stuff that you just mentioned, like proximity to fast food, but also, yeah, trying to embed these agents within that social model.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm not really up to date with the literature, but mm-hmm. from my understanding, a lot of these interventions, especially on a large scale, have not really delivered the expected mm-hmm. successful outcomes. Mm-hmm. But then I think also going back to the kind of fast food debate, it's been pretty interesting that a lot of countries or local authorities, especially in the UK, implemented bans on fast foods or some kind of zoning laws, especially surrounding children, like schools. So trying to reduce the access to these type of outlets for children. And this is not really based on any causal research. Because again, it's very, very difficult to kind of measure the causal effect on access. But I'm also thinking, like what you said about having an intervention that is delivered in one, on one platform, like for example, in schools, and then trying to nudge children to, you know, walk or like expand calories in some ways. I do think that this kind of space needs more kind of a more holistic approach to understand the social determinants and the behavior at the household level. Because I think even, you know, the question, does access to fast foods affect BMI, when we know that most of the decision making is being made at home, and there's a lot of persistence in BMI across time. So because of, from what I understand, it's difficult to kind of reduce the number of fat cells after reaching a certain age in childhood. So it also depends on when that intervention occurs. I just hope that the research would become more like multifaceted to understand at what level we should intervene, rather than just focusing on, you know, this determinant, a society level, school level, or individual level, and then understanding who has that ownership to, maybe ownership is the wrong word, but who, so also trying to understand when can children decide for themselves, and when are parents more in charge of decision making? I just think that the economics research on this has been pretty simplistic, as far as I know.
Okay, cool. Well, so you mentioned sort of taking a more mixed methods or multidisciplinary approach, and then you mentioned that the work that you're doing now is very much in that style with this public health work in Africa. So what are the methods that you guys are using in that work?
So I work within multidisciplinary global health projects. There has been some kind of more deeper collaboration on some work, but I guess the work that I have been mostly involved with has unfortunately not really tapped into the other disciplines of the project. So we have mostly been working together with epidemiologists and with political scientists looking at the governance of healthcare. So the main research questions have been to understand how to make decisions about resource scarce allocations going into health and healthcare, focusing on Malawi and Uganda. And then the EPI team focused on creating or generating model, creating this very big model of the healthcare system, which I think is very complex. So I'm afraid of saying, of describing this in more detail. But basically, this is supposed to follow an individual's step across, I think, the lifetime, trying to understand illness prevalence and then health-seeking behavior. And then my colleagues that are more involved in the more typical health economics discipline, concerned with economic evaluation, trying to understand value for money, cost effectiveness, how do we allocate scarce resources within the healthcare system, they kind of can latch on to that modeling to try to advise governments about the most cost-efficient interventions and the packages, for example, the essential health package in Malawi. And then we had, in the previous project, the political scientists that were then looking at how our decisions made, what kind of political or institutional constraints might there be, and also looking at donor funding and decision making across the whole spectrum. And then together with my co-author, we have mostly focused on trying to bring in the tools that are typically used in kind of industrial organization and health economics.
Mm-hmm.
So these tools have mostly been used in high income country research concerned mm-hmm. with health economics, trying to understand the markets, the ownership, competition, incentives with regards to how a provider is paid.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, fee for service or government salaries, etc. And so the kind of underpinning incentives are already there to exert effort, mm-hmm. to show up at work, and how this relates to quality of healthcare provision. And mm-hmm. And then we're also then trying to implement maybe methods that you and I are more kind of used in using, so applied microeconometrics, so causal inference, trying to apply natural experiments, difference in difference, matching, for example. So yeah, in my little work stream, we have mm-hmm. tried to, I'm very happy for my co-author who's doing the theory side,
yeah, which I'm sure.
That's not really my kind of expertise. So mm-hmm. yeah, going back to your question about the methods. So the methods that I am bringing into our questions about health policy are the traditional ones that we would use in, for example, development or labor economics that are, differences and differences, matching, and then more lately trying to come up, kind of be up to speed with the novel kind of more robust differences and differences estimators,
yeah,
as
sure.
well, which unfortunately have not been really applied in the global health literature fast
mm-hmm.
as compared to labor or development or education
mm-hmm.
economics. So more like traditional applied micro. So yeah, so I'm not really sure if I answered your question, but basically we're trying to bring in the conventional applied microeconometrics mm-hmm. Methods. And because we're still trying to publish in field economics journals,
yeah, sure.
but this is keeping in mind any kind of synergies that can mm-hmm. come about learning from what the epidemiologists and the political scientists are doing and the kind of feedback to them. And they're also feeding back to our work,
mm-hmm.
but I guess more of a kind of a seminar basis or in our own seminar series.
Yeah, sure. Okay, cool. Yeah, really good stuff. Wow, I love to see that kind of cross-pollination between fields. That really warms my heart. So I want to come back to some of the stuff you said there about the structure of healthcare markets and the incentives facing providers and that sort of thing. But maybe before we do that, we could just take a step back. I wanted to ask you about why healthcare is critical for development. So I guess some of the answer is pretty obvious, like it's hard for you to get a job if your leg's broken or something like that. But maybe beyond the obvious aspects, how do you see the role of healthcare and public health and that sort of thing in development?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think this is probably why I went into working on health-related mm. issues in the first place. So as you said, good health is needed to show up to work mm-hmm. and allocate time to work. And obviously there is an issue of well-being as well. So I guess it depends on how we measure development.
Yeah.
But if we would just measure it in a more conventional way, so we know that good health is a determinant of both productivity and growth.
Mm-hmm.
And because health is a crucial component of health capital, of human capital, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess on the macro level, I'm not really an expert of the macro literature, but I think there mm-hmm. are some robust cross-country estimates where we know that health, like you said, life expectancy or mortality, infant mortality, for example, are robust predictors of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be some evidence also saying that there is a relationship between mortality and risky behavior mm-hmm. and saving, FDI, for example, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to comment on the kind of causal relationship mm-hmm. of these like more macro type studies.
Sure.
But I think from a micro point of view, there is a lot of literature on health and health shocks and poverty traps, for example, mm-hmm. in development economics. And there is a lot of literature looking at how ill health in mm-hmm. early life, so from in utero to, I guess the most commonly is looked at, people define early life as up to age 2. Mm-hmm. So looking at how the health environment in early life affects permanent outcomes that as economists we're interested in, mm-hmm. such as income, and because of maybe of a lack of very long data, a lot of economists have been looking at educational outcomes, because we know that they are predictors of income and labor market participation, and then growth. So there's been a lot of literature looking at kind of fetal programming or shocks in early life and how that affects school attendance and educational outcomes, so schooling achievement. And there's been a lot of both current studies looking at weather-related shocks, and there's been a lot of studies looking at eradication of disease, for example, deworming in Kenya. I think the Kramer studies were quite famous. And then there's been a lot of studies looking at historical disease eradication and long-term outcomes. And that helps us to understand human capital development in the long term and for adults. So I guess a lot of this literature is more related to ill health with respect to nutrition. And they've mostly been the current ones that looked at some shocks or interventions using current data have mostly been looking at education outcomes. But we know that it's not just education that affects growth, but more so cognition. And that has led a lot of economists to look at a specific form of a micronutrient. So the macronutrients are, you know, protein and fats and carbs, and the micronutrients are more concerned with minerals and vitamins. And so the literature has moved into looking in, for example, at anemia or iron deficiency, looking at schooling outcomes. But what I and some other researchers have been looking at is how access to iodine affects human capital outcomes, because we know that iodine has a direct effect on cognitive outcomes because it's needed for brain development during a very early age. So this might have a direct effect on cognitive capabilities, and this may not show up in more traditional measures of health, such as height or stunting or wasting, for example. And so there's been a literature looking at the historical access to iodine, and which found positive effects on IQ in the US using data for male draftees. And there's also been some long-run estimates showing positive effects on labor market participation and income as well, after the historical experience of salt iodization in the US. And more, this has then motivated me to look into how a current public health policy in a low-income country or middle-income country such as India affects cognitive outcomes, again, which are very stark predictors of economic growth. So I looked into how the access to iodized salt coming from the exogenous change from a public policy that mandated the iodization of salt in India in 2005, and that was implemented in 2006, how that affected children's cognitive test scores. And then again, going back to your question about methods, because we know that there is a problem of selection, that maybe richer households have access to certain types of foods or more nutritious consumption of foods. So I again applied this type of, you know, differences natural experiment, coming from that at a certain time all of India had exogenously higher access to iodized salt, but then the difference, the kind of spatial difference The other difference depends on where you reside. Sure. So the access to iodine is kind of determined by where you live geographically, mm-hmm. because we intake iodine through foods that are grown on a certain soil that is naturally rich or poor in iodine. And this depends on glaciation, soil erosion, distance to the sea, etc. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of spatial fixed predictors of your geographical availability of iodine, and then also your risk of developing this deficiency. So using that spatial difference combined with the exogenous difference coming from this policy, I found that children in previously iodine deficient areas that had access to more iodine through mm-hmm. The SALT policy, did better in school, both in terms of basic skills for both boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And girls also benefited from the kind of more looking at literacy skills using kind of a bigger range of measurements. Mm-hmm. Not measurements, but using a 0 to 4 kind of scale. So not just the basic skill. And there was also an improvement in schooling progression as well. So I think I'm really fascinated about the kind of interaction between human biology and nutrition, and which then has a direct effect on cognitive test scores, mm-hmm. not necessarily affecting your years of schooling, mm-hmm. but hopefully having higher cognitive skills will help them in the labor market, which previous historical evidence has then supported. And this should then, in the future, impact economic growth.
Okay, cool. Well, so you mentioned quite a few things in there that I think come nicely into this next question then about what are some of the peculiarities of healthcare and health policy and health provision in developing countries? I know you mentioned that you've worked on the Indian case study and then also in East and Southern Africa. So in those two regions, what are some of the peculiarities around healthcare and access to it, that sort of thing?
Okay. Yeah. So I think there is a lot to say on this mm-hmm. question. So I guess, first of all, there is an issue of financial barriers to accessing mm-hmm. healthcare. All health systems are different. Like, we know that the American healthcare system and kind of financing for healthcare is very different mm-hmm. from many European countries. But I think the more kind of biggest difference is that low-income countries have a low level of public health expenditure mm-hmm. compared to, like, relative to their GDPs. So I think I've seen some numbers saying that the total healthcare expenditure in low-income countries is around 5% of GDP, while this is 10% in high-income countries. So the issue here is that we have a larger proportion of poor households, and they're also expected, or they have to pay out of pocket for healthcare because of the lack of government healthcare provision or economic support. Mm-hmm. So rather than healthcare being financed by governments, you know, financing coming from taxes, for example, while this is not really feasible for many low-income countries due to a high proportion of individuals working in the agricultural sector or in the informal sector, tax-financed care is not a really feasible option. And then, I mean, it is for some countries, or they're trying to move into that space. Mm-hmm. But then another issue is also that there isn't a lot of formal insurance. There's been mm-hmm. a lot of interesting and novel or innovative interventions looking at other types of insurance, or community-based health insurance or social health insurance. I think that is very interesting kind of literature. This is still not really the kind of reality in many mm-hmm. low-income countries. So the issue here that they have to pay, there's a higher proportion of households that have to pay out of pocket, which then can bring about catastrophic spending, mm-hmm. where, for example, I think 10 or 25% of the kind of their entire consumption is mm-hmm. spent towards healthcare. Yes. And then there is kind of a vicious circle of not taking up preventative healthcare, which then makes the shocks even bigger. So there could be a lot of financial shocks related to health. And then, so yeah, I think, so the financing side is different, or the pooling is different. Also, the shift infrastructure. So there is a scarcity of healthcare workers, skilled healthcare workers, physicians and nurses, etc. Is also a scarcity of just facilities, hospital beds, diagnostic testing. So for example, in high-income countries, you would have maybe more than 30 physicians per 10,000 individuals. That number is often less than one physician per 10,000 individuals in low-income countries. And so So healthcare is often costly. Healthcare is often far away because there are not that many facilities. And that also affects the transport costs and the opportunity costs of accessing healthcare. I guess this is also related to, like, these issues about infrastructure is also related to government capacity, which is constrained. And this is also related to, again, the infrastructure should also include the provision access to medicines. So there, it's very common with stockouts in public facilities, and where medicines are somehow disappearing to be sold privately.
But even in
the private market, the other issue is drug quality problems, where a lot of medicines are fake. So there is a poor provision of infrastructure or delivery of healthcare. It's lacking. The other issue is that there is a very low quality of care among in some countries and contexts. So even though there might be a facility open, there are issues with absenteeism, and this is often, I guess, more the case of government healthcare provision, and this might relate to how they're being, how healthcare workers are being incentivized to show up, because they know that they're being paid a fixed salary. So I guess there's not really an additional incentive to show up, or, you know, not take an extended break. And I guess this is, also related to exerting effort on the job. So I guess the previous literature was trying to understand if healthcare quality is quite poor. There is a really fascinating paper that kind of summarizes the literature from many studies from India and Africa, saying that the majority of patients using this method called standardized patients, where you train individuals or actors to pretend to be patients, to kind of keep their conditions, keep their characteristics, all the other things fixed. So you can kind of focus on what the providers are doing, what the supply side is doing, to understand the quality of care being provided, rather than worry about selection issues or indigeneity issues. And so this paper is saying that up to 50%, so less than 50% receive adequate quality of care. And if you would then include, if you would penalize those suggesting or providing unnecessary medicines, this would actually drop to 0 to 2%. So the majority of healthcare providers, even if they do show up, they don't really adhere to the guidelines when it comes to, you know, delivering quality of health care. And they're also then causing a lot of avoidable healthcare expenditure, which is important because these are usually poor populations who are already spending a lot of money on accessing healthcare. So I think the previous literature was trying to understand, is it the case that providers don't know what they should know? They don't have adequate training? But I think the most recent literature is saying that they seem to know, but they're still not doing it. And this might depend on their incentives coming, you know, how they're being paid, is it fee for service? But then also when we think about private providers that should feel incentivized to deliver good care so yeah. that the your clients are happy and might come back. They're still not doing that. And that might be due to reputational issues, and also that individual providers might think about how the patient might respond, and the patient might not come back to that provider because they think that they are inherently greedy. So okay, they might right. not act upon the advice. So there's a lot of, this is not really my research, but it seems to mm-hmm. be a lot of research suggesting that we should try to understand the interaction between mm-hmm. providers, understanding their incentives to deliver care and adequate care, and also trying to understand the dialogue and the kind of interaction coming from the patient. Yeah, and I think this is, again, going back to your question, what are the peculiarities? Again, going back to that, a lot of healthcare is not provided by the government in certain mm-hmm. settings. This is especially the case in India. They have a lot of private for profit, mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. small scale clinics or health posts. And there are also a lot of private for profit providers in Africa, but less so than okay. South Asia, from what I understand. But then you have a bigger non-governmental sector consisting of, for example, like charity or NGOs, but mostly so from faith-based organizations. Right, but then this sure. depends on maybe the history of the country. So I think that maybe those that were colonized by the UK, by the Brits, right. might have more kind of Christian missionaries okay. Setting up missionary hospitals. I might be wrong, but from what I understand, I do think that there is some more research to be done to understand the kind of colonial historical effects on the healthcare system that we see today. Mm-hmm. But we do see today that estimates are suggesting that 30 to 70% of all healthcare mm-hmm. in sub-Saharan Africa is provided by the faith-based sector, and okay. mostly so Christian and Catholic, including Catholic organizations. And they often charge user fees. Mm-hmm. So even though many countries in Africa abolished user fees at government or public hospitals or facilities, the big proportion of healthcare providers, which are not governmental, are still charging user fees. Mm. Then, you know, going back to what I said about poor quality of healthcare coming from infrastructure, medicine, mm-hmm. etc., mm-hmm. some of the faith-based and other kind of private ones might have a reputation of delivering higher quality of care.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess the healthcare system in many low and middle income countries is more fragmented and consists of kind of a diverse array of different players. And I think from talking to my co-author who works at the Ministry of Health in Malawi, that mm-hmm. They know that the non-governmental sector is growing.
Right.
But they don't have sufficient information about, you know, what are they doing? Who are they?
Sure, yeah, I can imagine.
How does this interact with the government's healthcare provision? So I think that is an interesting area for further mm-hmm. research.
Sorry, just to interrupt you for a brief question. On that point you made about how the, you know, something like only 60% or 40% of places are offering a high quality of care, and then if you take out unnecessary or overpriced medicines, it falls to 2%. Is that kind of negligent prescription, is that a function of profiteering? Is it a function of quack doctors prescribing nonsense remedies? Is it a function of the consumers, like the patients coming in wanting particular remedies that they think work but that aren't the guideline remedies, but a for-profit provider just gives people what they want? Can you elaborate a bit? That's just such a striking statistic. I'd like to know a bit more about it.
These are really good suggestions. I think it's probably a combination of all of these factors. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, we know that patients or clients in low-income countries often have less information mm-hmm. about. First of all, if you're not a doctor, there is, you know, and there's a problem with asymmetrical information mm-hmm. in this kind of physician-client relationship. And we have to trust and rely on the physician to be our kind of principal mm-hmm. looking out for our healthcare needs. So I guess that is one aspect, lack of information. Mm-hmm. We also mentioned that individuals can demand a specific treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think from what I understand in with regards to malaria, which is which contributes to a large burden of disease, mm-hmm. especially in sub-Saharan Africa, that's individuals are often expecting a certain treatments, like for example antibiotics or for other mm-hmm. for other you know, fever or cough. Mm-hmm. I think the clients feel satisfied when they feel when there's been some kind of signaling that they have been treated. So I think that is an issue of kind of over medication uh-huh. and lack of diagnostic testing. Mm-hmm. That the guidelines are then asking the provider to carry out a certain test, a certain series of tests. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's because of, you know, again, lack of infrastructure, lack of diagnostic capability that they're not able to do so. Maybe it's because of a high workload. You know, there's a long queue outside your door mm-hmm. And you want to just satisfy the kind of expectations of the client. So mm-hmm. you just give out antibiotics or other type of quick treatments that is then, you know, mm-hmm. causing a negative externality yep, because yep. we do care about antimicrobial resistance. And then you also mentioned the incentive structures. I do think that we see that the kind of over medication and over prescription is more prevalent among private for-profit providers compared sure. to government providers. Mm-hmm. So I think that is an observation that also makes sense. But I think that there isn't really a consensus about why there is very low quality of care. Mm-hmm. Because I guess that we are discussing different providers with different incentives across different populations for different service areas. Mm-hmm. But this paper that I just recently came across is saying that in the case of private for-profit providers in India that should have an incentive to provide care or align their actions with the kind of expected guidelines mm-hmm. to provide high quality of care, they're still not doing so because of them being worried that the client will not come back to them because the client might perceive their action as a way for them to make a profit. So, and because of that kind of reputational issue, they are then prescribing kind of not the right medicines or not the right treatments, or saying, for example, they know that they should refer this individual to this facility, but the individual is worried that this will cost them money and they're just sure. trying to make a profit. So they say, okay, try this medicine, go home and let me see how it goes and come back. But they know that that is not the adequate line of protocol, but they right. do so just to earn that trust
sure.
From my reading of that paper. Mm-hmm. So hopefully more research, trying to look at both the supply and the demand side will help us to answer that question, because mm-hmm. I still haven't really like concluded in my head what the answer to this question is.
Is there ethnographic work on that sort of thing? It sounds like you might need to get more kind of on the ground observations in order to tease through that.
Yeah, there is. And I think the anthropological literature was motivated this mm-hmm. Study that I just discussed in India to look into the interaction between providers and clients. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to understand because if we only look at the supply side, trying to understand the financial incentives or motivations or objectives coming from the organization ownership from a facility, then we also care about how the demands or preferences or expectations from the individuals play into this. So I've been trying to read more kind of health policy, global health qualitative research to understand. So apparently a lot of the research about like using interviews, they're saying that government providers are just rude. They yell. They're not nice. So people don't want to go there. Yeah, I was just really shocked. So I don't know as an economist if I can do any research on this, but I would like to understand why nurses working government facilities are known to be very rude. I read some papers where the patients said that the government nurses were screaming at them when they were in pain during labor. So they were visibly in pain. And then I think the nurse said something like, "Oh, why are you screaming? You shouldn't scream now. I wasn't there when you had the baby, so you shouldn't scream." I think that as economists we have a lot to learn, because I didn't understand why someone working in medical care would want to scream these things or be quite rude.
I'm a big advocate of a little bit of qualitative research, even if it's not something that you publish on or whatever. It's just a way to get a granular understanding of what you're working on. I think all quant researchers should do some qualitative experience in their field, and vice versa. So the qual people really need to have some idea of what's in, like, the technical challenges involved in running a robust statistical analysis, because it's quite overwhelming. And it's just because I started doing qualitative research myself recently, I was so struck that the sort of training required to do qualitative research is, dare I say it, not very time consuming. Like, you can sort of do one little course and you're ready to rock, just like go off and do an ethnography. And obviously it takes a lot of skill and talent and stuff, but it's not something that you can really teach. Whereas in quantitative research, we have, you know, like 8 course series now, hundreds of hours, very specific protocols on what you need to go through. I think it's useful to see both sides of the aisle, as it were.
Yeah, so have you been able to implement both like mixed methods in your own research?
I'm a big mixed methods person. I think what I haven't done is I have not done experimental work, either quantitative or laboratory, and I guess I should probably try to do more of that sort of thing, because I rely a lot on experimental results in psychology, and then some of my colleagues notify me that the theories that I like the most tend to have the shakiest empirical results backing them, and the stuff that I don't like has kind of not necessarily better empirical results. I mean, I think just everything is kind of bad in a way, but that I probably am selectively applying an empirical standard. Yeah. So anyway, it's just always stay humble in research, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe one question I think we've got about maybe 5 to 10 minutes left. One big question to finish on then is how you see healthcare in Africa in particular evolving over the next, I shouldn't say Africa, because Africa's so heterogeneous. So in the countries you work in, how do you see healthcare and this research space evolving over the next 10 years? What are going to be the issues going forward?
That's a very big question. I'm not sure whether I am like the most competent person to act as an oracle into the future of African healthcare research. But I can share some of my kind of thoughts, and I tried to kind of reach out to some of my networks, which are quite, I guess, diverse. And I guess I think maybe some of my thoughts are just based on my own research interests, what I would like to see people do. But
well, I'm happy to hear that too. Just talk about what you'd like to see there.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that there'll be a continuation of I guess, continuation of more interdisciplinary work, which you just mentioned, but also applying the more rigorous tools which people have been using, both in theory and in methodology, from people working on high-income countries. So again, trying to understand market structure, incentives, ownership, which is like related to what we've been looking at, like health policies and contracting with non-governmental providers. Also, because I think this hasn't been done too much. From my understanding, I might be completely wrong, is that development economists have often used smaller scale RCTs, often looking at the demand for preventative healthcare products, so completely kind of disregarding the conventional healthcare system, or looking at performance-based or kind of results-based or performance-based financing within certain service areas, within some clinics. So they've either looked at the supply or demand side separately. I'm aware that there's a lot of interesting research trying to combine both facility level data or experiments with kind of surveys following up on the clients or patients. So I think that is super exciting. So I hope to see more of that. And I also hope to see more of, and I think there is already, in both the development and kind of global health side, where you look at competition, ownership. There is a really interesting paper looking at how stockouts of medicines at public facilities affect the prices of of medicines at private shops or pharmacists in Uganda. That's really interesting. And I think it's also interesting to see that there is some work employing industrial organization toolkit, seeing how the competition between non-governmental, non-for-profit providers react to the proximity to for-profit providers. So I am very happy to see that there is more of a kind of this rigor coming from industrial economics being applied to low-income country settings. And there's also trying to understand the interaction with supply and demand sides. And what else? So I guess this is also could also be extended to not looking at kind of small scale RCTs or small scale kind of experiments, but looking at larger scale health policies, because we know that there's a lot of countries like Rwanda or Ghana that have implemented health insurance program at a national scale. So it'd be super interesting to see how these kind of large scale policies affect incentives or performance at the supply side, and also how this might affect behavior responses or even fertility behavior from the demand side. And then, again, like there are so many topics that people are studying in health economics from high-income countries, like reputation, for example, which I think that some development economists also study. But yeah, it would be interesting to see kind of how we can learn from high-income countries in terms of the studies that they have been doing and apply that to low-income country settings. And I think this is also related to availability of high-quality data. And I've seen a lot of impressive studies using like health insurance data from India. And I hope that, and I know that there are initiatives implementing national ID cards or electronic registers or data in low and middle income countries as well. So hopefully there will be more data available, like administrative healthcare data and electronic registers, which we can use. So we don't only have to rely on kind of small scale RCTs or cross-sectional only facility or kind of household survey data. And I think this is also echoing the demand for data coming from health economists in Africa, because I attended the African Health Economics Association conference. And I think many researchers were saying that we need to collect more data. We need to stop being so afraid of data. We can learn a lot from data. And then obviously there would be a difference in, you know, type of diseases that we need to study. So I think it's really exciting that there has been an increase in research on mental health and the kind of intersection mm-hmm. between psychology and neuroscience and economics. So, and because we know that there is a socioeconomic gradient in mental mm-hmm. ill health. So it'd be super interesting to see more research on mental health. And also we know that the disease burden is shifting. So mm-hmm. low and middle income countries are in the process of unfortunately suffering from a double burden of both infectious and communicable disease and non-communicable mm-hmm. diseases. So right. because of urbanization and economic growth, etc., malaria, TB, HIV, these kind of infectious diseases will also be accompanied by diseases such as diabetes and cardiovascular ill health as well, and obesity and other chronic illnesses related to longer health lifespans as well. So I think that research needs to be responsive to the changing health needs or the changing health landscape. Mm-hmm. And hopefully in the future, or at least something I've learned working at the Center for Health Economics with my colleague and line manager, Paul Revel, is that there has been a focus on partnering and especially equitable partnerships. Mm-hmm. So rather than, you know, researchers from high-income countries coming and setting up RCTs and telling other people what to do, we're trying to collaborate with the researchers and policymakers and stakeholders in the countries of concern, mm-hmm. and more importantly, building expertise and capability by sharing training materials and just interacting, and try to support both financially and, you know, with any capability or other types of support, setting up research centers, and I think they're called, is it called like research centers of excellence in the African region as well. And partnering with universities to train not just economists but mm-hmm. also health economists. Yeah, so I hope I don't know if that is what I expect to see, but at least what mm-hmm. I hope to see.
Okay, great. Well, I always love to finish on an optimistic or hopeful note, so that's a good place to pull to a close. So thanks very much for coming on the show. That was a wonderful discussion, and thanks very much.
Thank you very much. It was really nice to talk to you.
If you enjoyed today's episode, my guests and I would be ever so grateful if you could please leave a review of Apodstomology on whatever podcast directory you use, and share, like, comment, or subscribe if those are options. Tell your friends about the show, and we'll see you next episode.